All right, everybody, welcome back to the show. It's the Weekend Interview Show. I'm your host, Philip Drew, Administrator. We're going to switch gears a little bit now from beer to war. Our guest is Bill Kelsey. He was raised in Jordan, spent many years of his life in the Middle East, and has recently been flying relief missions into Baghdad. He has experience also flying relief missions into the Congo after a volcano there a couple of years ago, and Mozambique, Sierra Leone, much experience in the Middle East and Africa flying relief missions. Welcome to the show, Mr. Kelsey.
Well, thank you very much.
Okay, I read an email that you wrote that was forwarded to me about your experiences recently flying relief missions into Baghdad. I guess actually before we get too much into that, maybe I should ask you a little more about your background. You can explain to us how you got into this business.
Well, I'm a pilot. When I'm here in Texas, I mostly flight instruct and do a little bit of air taxi work. But way back when I began working on my pilot's license in the 80s, my goal was to work for a company called AirServe. Their motto is they use the power of aviation to bring hope to a suffering world. And so where there's a disaster and where people are trying to fly in to deal with the consequences, be it the staff, usually it's the staff of relief organizations, occasional medevac work, AirServe is there, and they have contracts with USAID in some countries, with the UN in other countries, and sometimes they just have the contracts with various NGOs such as Doctors Without Borders or World Vision and so on.
I see. So what was your first mission?
Well, my first job with these folks was in 97, went off to Mozambique, and among other responsibilities, we were on standby for Halo Trust, who were clearing landmines, and our job was to fly them out if anybody had an accident. Happily, none had one while I was there, though we flew their staff in and out of their areas of operation. And flew people from World Vision and Food for the Hungry and numerous other organizations around the Zambezi River Valley. And that was done for 2 years. And I've also flown with another company in Panama fighting the screwworm. That's where we let go millions of sterilized versions of a fly. That's a real pest to cattle and other warm-blooded creatures, and we would release those by the millions after flying up and down lines back and forth across Panama. And
oh, wow, so the sterilized flies would then just take the place of the regular ones and get rid of them.
Well, what would happen is that these flies would search out the normal ones. A fellow actually was in Texas, a guy by the name of Risley, figured out that the way to fight insects was to breed them by the millions in laboratories, zap them with nuclear radiation, and then release them. And then they would go out and search for the normal ones. They'd seduce them, have a moment of pleasure, and then they'd all die childless of old age, which they'd reach in a few days. So that's
very interesting.
This fly, you can tell how old people are if they've heard about it, and they're Texans. They're usually about 50 or 60 years old. It used to be one of the main jobs of cowboys here in Texas, and then they used this technique to get rid of them in the United States, and gradually they worked their way down through Central America, and now it's a pest just in Panama and Jamaica. And oddly enough, it's a problem in Iraq now.
That's funny. I was just written a note that when they did that here in Texas, the deer population exploded. So maybe some unintended consequences.
Yeah, it's I had my friend tell me, look, you're just helping the cattle industry and so forth, and I had other people tell me, no, this is a terrible insect and you're doing the world a great favor by getting rid of it. So who knows?
I sure don't. And you know, flying relief missions into volcano victims in the Congo is surely a lot higher scale than dropping fleas over Panama.
Yeah. So anyway, then I've done a 3-month contract in Guinea, where I was flying in Liberia and Sierra Leone, And that was a year and a half ago. I was in Congo. By coincidence, the volcano was there. And though the work was part of an ongoing project to do relief work in eastern Congo for victims of the war, the volcano wasn't something that we had to address ourselves, except that a flow of lava went across the runway and basically cut the northern third of it off, but it was still enough for us to land on. And that was just coincidence. I wasn't there because of the volcano.
Now, are you there in the war zone, or you wait until the war's over and then come and help the victims after that? Or?
Well, the airplane's a little bit too valuable to be shot up, and so they try to keep that out of the actual hot fighting. My passengers get a lot closer to where things are dangerous than we do. They try to make sure that we land at airfields that are secured by one army or another, or a strong militia, and hopefully a disciplined militia of sorts. And that can lead to problems. We've had a few uncomfortable moments in Congo, landing at the wrong runway or landing at a runway after another militia other than the one we had negotiated with took over the field. And you learn how to be very polite when you're surrounded with militiamen with drawn rifles.
I expect so.
Yeah, but it works out in the end. I found the best technique is to do a language lesson. People are less likely to kill me when I'm studying their language.
Oh, yeah, that sounds like a pretty good strategy.
Yeah, so I got a good Swahili lesson out of my one tough time in Congo.
Do you have your planes marked very clearly that you're a relief mission and not a military plane?
Yeah, well, not so that they can be seen from the ground, and we get pot shots every so often. When they're on the ground, though, there's a painting of a rifle with the international forbidden symbol, you know, the circle with a line through it over a automatic rifle, and that's supposedly to tell people that we don't haul weapons or ammunition, and if you have a rifle, you're invited not to bring it aboard.
Very nice. So how did you get into flying relief missions into Iraq?
Okay, it was with the same company, AirServe, that I flew within those three countries in Africa that I told you about. Is a unique situation, and one that's caused a lot of ethical anguish or ethical debate about what's right and wrong. See, now, AirServe plus many organizations such as Save the Children, World Vision, you name them, they get money from USAID, a few crumbs off the emperor's table, as it were. And the people, as you imagine, that are in these organizations, they're not pro-war types. After all, they're doing war relief. And so they'll be working in Congo and dealing with two different African armies or two different militia groups, or in Mozambique, we'd be working with the government that won the war. And people tend to forget or put aside the fact that the money might be coming from the U.S. government. In the case of my dream job that I got, I mean, what could be better than to help people clear landmines? Well, it just so happened that that landmine clearing job was subsidized by U.S. aid. Well, the United States government was voting against banning landmines, but whenever they'd cast their vote, they'd say, however, the United States spends this many million dollars clearing landmines. And that's what I was doing. They'd hire Halo Trust to clear landmines in Mozambique and then have an airplane on hand to evacuate them if they got hurt. So we'd live with that. We're doing a good thing. We're clearing landmines, even if we might be slightly uncomfortable about who's sending us the money and why they're sending it. Now we get up to Iraq, and lo and behold, it's not two African militias. It's not a African revolution and an African government. It's the person, the charitable entity that is funding us is also the belligerent, the U.S. government. So you have one arm of the octopus waging war, and another arm of the octopus is in place, in position, trying to clean things up. We had a contract with the Office of Foreign Disaster Assistance. We still do. I just went over for a two-month contract that went on for 3.5. But the contract is to haul a group of people in called the DARTs, Disaster Assistance Response Teams. And these are civilians who go on contract with USAID. We fly them into Iraq, and their purpose was to help try to put the country together. In addition to those people, we'd have people from Save the Children go with us, Physicians for Human Rights, and dozens of other organizations that I can't even remember. Actually, there are literally hundreds of organizations that are trying to get on the action of putting Iraq back together. And all, both us as individuals within AirServ and people in these other organizations had real ethical dilemmas about the fact that we're accepting U.S. aid money. It's, you have a vandal that's going around blowing things up, and the vandal says, hey, can you clean things up after I destroy them? And we can say yes, in which case that enables the vandal to continue smashing things, and we become sort of enablers, as it were.
In a way, you're kind of making it easier for them to go to war against these countries.
Exactly. On the other hand, if we say, no, we're not going to do this, then what happens is people do suffer. So it's not an easy situation. And it has gotten a little more complicated because the head of USAID has put the word out that all you people that are relief organizations, you have to make it clear that you are part and parcel of U.S. foreign policy. Don't go around being embarrassed about where you get your money from. Make sure everybody knows that you're part of the American system and that you are part of the occupation. Well, people that volunteer to work for organizations like Save the Children, that's not their sentiment. And it's not the sentiment of the pilots that went to AirServ, so we had some hard times about what we were doing. Though there were people going in there that did good works. And, you know, I hope I was harmless and that some of my passengers might have been useful. And we have reason to believe that we had some shady passengers, too.
In what way, shady passengers?
Well, you know what I mean when you see a guy sort of wink and say, yeah, I'm an advisor to Paul Bremer, and yeah, I'm a humanitarian, and he sort of winks his eye with a sinister grin. He made one of our pilots so annoyed that he resigned. But, yeah.
It's like they're just trying to rub it in your face. They know how you guys feel about that kind of thing.
Maybe. Who knows? But, yeah, I mean, it's very fascinating because here it is. It's all one machine. It's one octopus. It's one entity, the U.S. Empire. It's doing all these things in Iraq. And, yeah, you have a big spectrum. Even people who are full-time employees of the government that were over there didn't approve of the war. And the people that the U.S. government was hiring to help put Iraq together after it was blown up, they were, not to the press, but internally and to us, they had serious doubts about what was going on. In fact, these DART teams, there was one rumor that they, when it looked like the United States might invade Syria, they were going to resign en masse. And you have all these, I wrote this to you in the email, they have all these different levels and layers of people who the farther, they like to believe they're more and more innocent. So you have people who are humanitarians who do not get any money from the U.S. government, but even they have to collude in order to get into Iraq. They have to sign up and get approved to go in there or somehow sneak across the border.
And you guys are really stuck between a rock and a hard place here where if they invade Syria and you guys all resign, then the humanitarian crisis is even worse. It's not going to stop George Bush from doing what he does.
Exactly. Of course, I don't think that they're going to be able to invade Syria or Iraq. They've really bitten off a lot more than they can chew, right, just with this Iraq misadventure. But to go on with what you were saying, the director of USAID put out the word, and the buzz is among all the aid organizations that are having second thoughts about participating in Iraq. They're saying, well, this is just too awkward ethically. Let's not follow through with this. Let's not try to get our contracts extended. And USAID is saying, oh, no, wait a minute. You don't play ball with us in Iraq. We don't give you the contract to fight AIDS in Uganda or Congo, or we don't give you the contract to improve agriculture in Mozambique. So you want your projects in the rest of the world, you deal with us here in Iraq.
Now, help me understand, Mr. Kelsey. Are they just stupid, or would they prefer that the humanitarian problems in Iraq continue?
No, they. I think they genuinely don't want that. There was one forum in Kuwait where I was actually based, and they have the same forum going on in Jordan and also in Iraq itself, where the civil affairs units of the military and a few other soldiers there are military people assigned to humanitarian operations, and many of them really are sincere and they really want to do a good thing. Just the accident of history has put them into this situation. So we'd have a meeting every day where, you know, what was called the Humanitarian Operations Center, Kuwaiti military, American military, and British military, and then all of these aid NGOs, non-governmental organizations, ranging from Doctors Without Borders to Refugees International, International Rescue Committee, War Child. I could go on forever. All the little NGOs that would come, and they would be at this meeting, and the military would stand up and say, "This hospital lacks generators. There's cholera in that town. There's fighting in this city." And there would be coordination, and they would also respect the fact that most of the NGOs had problems with the military, and they would make statements like, "We have an empty C-130 going up to Iraq. We understand that you all have problems. If you want to ride on it, you're welcome. If you'd like to ride in our convoys, you're welcome, but we understand if you don't." And so we were allowed that freedom to cooperate or not cooperate with them. Where we had to cooperate was, for example, getting visas. If you want to go do something nice in Iraq, you end up having to get after you're recognized as a legitimate humanitarian, you get the visa application goes to a military staffer, an American woman, actually, and then she would look it over and then turn it over to the Kuwaiti Minister of Interior that has an office set up at this particular compound, and they'd get you the visa in 1 or 2 days, which is really fast. It would be a special humanitarian visa. So we all had to collude with the military to some extent, some more than others. For example, we would go into this place and have meetings with them. But when they offered to let us use some of the space for our offices, we said no, except for a few organizations. For example, Pat Robertson has a humanitarian organization called Operation Blessing. So they had no problem. They set their office right up there in the military compound. Unfortunately, I flew their people in once.
Yeah, well, this war wouldn't have happened without Pat Robertson and the pressure that he created.
Oh man, they're a threat to themselves and others. They're not that different from religious Muslims. So anyway, that's basically what we're doing. We also had to work with the military on actually getting permission to fly in. Each flight we had to tell them what time we were taking off from Kuwait, when we were crossing the border, when we were landing in Baghdad, when we were taking off, etc., and leaving the country, and then they would come back and give us permission and maybe alter our times one way or the other.
I don't understand. I'm trying to understand why the alienation. I mean, why can't they just let you guys be as independent as you can be?
Well, from their point of view, I mean, I'm not their defender or anything, but as far as airplanes going in, they have, there are lots of airplanes in the sky, including warplanes, and they need to keep us away from those. There are airplanes coming, they needed to keep us separate from each other. They needed to know where all of the airplanes were that are legitimately in the country, and then we all had assigned squawk codes. That's a four-digit code that is being beamed out of a transponder on the airplane. So they had to know who we were. And I didn't, and this timing was also to keep us from bumping into each other. Now, we also had to do another thing when I was halfway through this, which was all NGOs that came into Baghdad. Before our airplane could get permission to go in, we had to submit the names of all our passengers, their passport numbers, and their nationalities. And then we would get permission to land there.
So in your email, you talk about how the situation in Baghdad is quite a bit different than they say on TV news all the time. And I noticed that just this week, for the first time, our military admitted that, in fact, we are in what it could be called a guerrilla war, and that all the people that are shooting at our soldiers over there are not all Saddam loyalists being directed by the Ba'ath Party from some basement, but are actually, in great part, just plain old Iraqis shooting at our occupying soldiers. And I wonder if you can just maybe give us some anecdotes and explain a little bit of what you know from being on the scene there.
Yeah, most of my experience in the Middle East has been in Jordan and with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and then I have been to Iraq before after the first Gulf War. It's not going to get any better. There was maybe a very small window of opportunity where if the Americans had behaved just a little bit differently, they could have stayed in good graces a little longer. But what's... the problem with Americans and similar with the Israelis, there's, in order to keep from getting shot in the short run, they do things to protect themselves in the short run that make people hate them and want to shoot them in the long run. So any given soldier has a choice between risking his life immediately or doing something that is going to make a few other soldiers in a few weeks get shot. And that's the dilemma that each GI faces right now. In order to, it's hard to be friendly to people because you don't know who's going to shoot at you. In order to protect yourself, you have to do things that insult the local people. And local people get insulted. You get shot at from a neighborhood, so you have to run into the in their view, they have to run into the neighborhood and go into the houses and tear up houses and wake people up at 3 a.m, handcuff all the children together, and search the house. Well, now, at the end of the dawn, you might have found a few rifles, but you've made a whole lot more people angry that want to shoot at you, here you got people on the street that are apparently they're not disapproving completely of people shooting at the soldiers. It's a sad situation, and it's not going to get any better. It just all you can do is, for precedent, I would look at the Israeli occupation of South Lebanon, and to say nothing of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank. We're basically going to be there until a ways. Someday a presidential candidate or Congress will say, let's get us out of this mess.
So this really is the definition of quagmire. We can't create a democracy because they'd elect a guy who hates us.
Partly. One other analogy I wanted to give was that when the Germans invaded the Soviet Union, there were a lot of people were that in Ukraine and various of the eastern or western part of Russia, people that were so angry with Stalin and felt so oppressed by Stalin that they welcomed the Nazis. And there's plenty of film footage of this. But that lasted about 2 weeks, and then they found out the Nazis were creeps too, and turned against him. So when the Americans did go in and the British went into Iraq, they did get a lot of greetings. They did get people cheering them or welcoming them. But that lasted a lot less time than I had imagined. I mean, it didn't take long for them to get angry with the Americans. And
that's funny that you bring up Ukraine, because I was just reading in the last week here an article about how the Ukraine had welcomed the Russians in originally as well, and as liberators, and then it wasn't very long before Stalin turned on them, and then now you're fleshing out the story a little more. They turned around and welcomed the Germans to come and save them from the Russians, and then they got it even worse too.
Right. So that happens. And I don't know how long that was shown here in the States. I was over there, but I don't know if they had cheering people for 2 or 3 days or 1 week. But
they tried to show us as much cheering people as they possibly
could. Yeah, I mean, even the famous scene of the statue getting pulled down when there were pictures taken from farther away. It was a really small crowd.
And they were all the exiles that we had just brought into the country with us.
I guess, yeah, and it was completely staged. Now there are many people who are angry with the Ba'athists, and he genuinely had enemies, and for good reason. The thing is that the people who are against Saddam Hussein are also going to have to be putting on a show of opposition to the United States in order to enhance their own credibility. In other words, for somebody to be a credible alternative to Saddam Hussein, they have to not look like collaborators. And even the collaborators that we appoint or that decide to work with us, they're going to have to put on a show. Like the policemen in Fallujah, they said, okay, we'll work for the Americans, but Americans, please get out of town, because with you being around, the people want to shoot at us. So if you want us to patrol Fallujah on your behalf, please hide, stay away from us, don't embarrass us.
God, and it's only been a couple of months.
Yeah. And by the way, I mean, no consolation to the people who are dying, but it's still just the beginning. I mean, these are just the small numbers of people. And the idea that, oh, after a certain amount of time we will have killed and captured all of the people that are attacking our soldiers, that's fantasy. I mean the very act of doing all of that creates more of them.
Basically, I mean, you're speaking to Iraq particularly now, but you could take that same statement and apply it to the entire war on terrorism, couldn't you?
Unfortunately, to some extent, yeah. Yeah, and I mean, I was hanging out with Kuwaitis, and the Kuwaitis are the one group of Arabs that are very pro-American, and I befriended a few of them, and even I remember one of the last conversations I had, they said that the Americans were so frightened, the American GIs were their way of behaving in Iraq, rooted in their own fear of the population, was such that it made them provocative, and so many even the Kuwaitis who were pro-American were just having doubts, not about America itself, but just the techniques of the Americans and the fact that it's not Mother Teresa when you have soldiers patrolling a foreign city.
Well, and these soldiers, to be fair to them, they were trained how to kill people in a war
and were
promised they would go home, and now they're being made to be police officers, and they don't know how to do that job.
Yeah, and right after they've been in combat, and mind you, the heat there is enough to drive anyone crazy. It's the main thing you're supposed to do is, well, in Kuwait, the city shuts down at 12 o'clock at noon, and then people basically have lunch and then sleep till 4:30, and then the city starts waking up again. And
that sounds cool. We need to start doing that here in Central
Texas. Yeah, in Texas. Yeah, speaking of soldiers, I wanted to just share one of the things that struck me pretty powerfully when I was there. Most of the time when I went in, I was only at the airport, so I interacted with American GIs at Baghdad and Erbil, and then in Basra with British soldiers. And I did have one overland trip before we started flying. We did one overland trip from Kuwait up to Baghdad Airport, and actually got a little bit lost and wandered around through some back roads and battlefields, and saw all these hapless donkeys loaded down with stuff that people were salvaging from burned out tanks. So went up there, and while I was on that road, I saw two armored personnel carriers pulling over for some reason, and there also happened to be a crowd of kids. And the soldier jumped up to the machine gun. The thing is slowing down. There was a bunch of kids. Who knows, one of the kids might throw something, so you got to be... the soldier has to get behind the 50 caliber machine gun and be ready. Well, it was a woman. So right here on the banks of the Euphrates River, we have a Western woman. I think the ship's woman might have been British. And here she is aiming a 50 caliber machine gun at children. Is this what the feminists had in mind when they wanted women to get liberated? And I thought it was a very sad and unfortunate sight. And I saw it again, in fact, my last landing in Baghdad, which was on June 29th. There was a Humvee full of women's Air Force security guards. And I've seen women in uniform just going through airports, but they're wearing their traveling clothes. And I've gotten used to the fact that, or I thought I'd gotten used to the fact that women liberated themselves in this case by mimicking male savagery. But to actually see a woman dressed to kill, actually dressed to kill with not clean and nicely pressed trousers, but greasy, dusty trousers and rolled up shirt sleeves and a helmet with things written on the helmet, and sitting on top of a Humvee and sitting behind the machine gun. It was mixed with a certain admiration that she could do this. And just a regular, normal American, I could have been talking to a college girl. They weren't much older than my two daughters, and so it was quite a sight to see. And here she was just asking me, "Hey, man, do you have any alcohol? It's been a long time." So I talked to her a little bit. Since I was based in Kuwait, and Kuwait's a dry country, I couldn't help her out. But, of course, I found a pilot from a freight company that was based in Bahrain where they do have alcohol, and I introduced them to each other. I might have started a liquor smuggling ring at Baghdad Airport for all I know, but they looked like they were getting ready to get married by the time I left, and they were so happy to meet each other. Yeah, just regular American kids, nice young woman, and here she is dressed up in all these... It could have been a Girl Scout at a Girl Scout camp wanting somebody to slip her a six-pack at night.
And now she's going to learn great black market smuggling skills when she comes home.
Yeah, but there was a hard thing to for me to process. When I was in the service, we didn't have women all dressed to kill like that. So that was one sight I wanted to just... share that I saw.
Well, and it's our civilians that we somehow elect here that put young girls in that kind of situation where she has to be ready to shoot a bunch of children.
Yeah, you never know what the children are going to do. I mean, it's each step in itself is a logical step that makes perfect sense, and then you add up all of these little steps together and you get some crazy scene like a woman pointing a gun at children in Iraq. That's completely perverted. So I'd like to see a debate happen and a real investigation go on here in America, not just about this document of the yellow cake and the Niger uranium that they're talking about these days, and a few misstatements in the intelligence reports. I'd like a very, very deep, and maybe if this turns into a quagmire, you know, that this we're just seeing the beginning of, if this really gets horrible, there might be the, I'm hoping that the people, instead of just becoming more stupid and getting angry with the Iraqis for not appreciating us, I hope they do a complete investigation, not just of support for Saddam Hussein in recent years, which has been talked about, but even to the point when he was 18 years old and as a Ba'ath Party member started assassinating communists, he came to, which was the rival party of the Ba'athists in Iraq in the late 50s and 60s. Well, he came to the attention of the CIA, and they facilitated his career as a Ba'ath Party assassin, and they made life easy for him. I've read a few sources, a few stories here and there, and he went up, he was involved in an attempted assassination effort against Abdul Karim Qasim. The assassination effort failed, and a few years later his crew of people finished the job correctly while he was out of the country, and then he came back. But all along, he had been on the American team. I would like a nice inquiry. Whose idea was this? What were you thinking? What are we all thinking when we have this ends justifies the mean? Let's hire this person to kill that person, or those people are really, the communists are really horrible, so let's hire a serial killer Ba'athist assassin to just systematically execute them. And what was the next thing? You know, one of the little known details is that Saddam Hussein was actually one of the first Iraqis to come out and say that Kuwait is a separate country. The Iraqis have good reason for believing that Kuwait should be part of Iraq historically. All Iraqis believe that. Now, Saddam Hussein was actually the first Iraqi to say, okay, I'll acknowledge Kuwait as a separate country, and I'll put in an Iraqi embassy there. And he got rewarded by the United States and Britain for that. That's essentially how he became head of state. Khomeini frightened us. The Iranian Revolution frightened people, and they said, well, what better way than to mess up this program in Iran than to send our junkyard dog against him. And the United States, Britain, and Kuwait and various Arab countries, they supported this guy. And I would like a complete investigation of that. In my really dark moments, I would like this investigation to be sort of about the level of intensity that the prisoners in Guantanamo Bay are getting. You know, no, I assume there's no torture, right? You assume that. So whatever the standards are at Guantanamo Bay, I have a fantasy of applying them, get the old CIA people out of their retirement homes and sit them down, ask them some questions. My nicer side, when I'm in a better mood, I say, let's do a Truth and Reconciliation Committee. You people spill the beans. Tell us everything you did. There aren't any more communists in the world. The Soviet Union's, so don't use national security as an excuse. Most of the stuff that is secret in the U.S. government is to protect the government from embarrassment. It's not to protect the security of the United States. So, come on, you guys. Tell your secrets, and you get complete amnesty. Not prosecution, amnesty. Tell every secret, tell everything you did. What did you think you were doing? What did you think you would accomplish? How did you justify it ethically? On and on, and just cover everything from when Saddam Hussein was first put on the CIA payroll till these days.
I was going to ask you, you mentioned support for him in recent years, and I was wondering, were you referring to between the last war and this one?
No, no, no. By recent years, I'm showing my age. By recent years, I mean up until the end of the Iran-Iraq war. I guess that was in the late 80s.
Because I've met, truthfully, I've met Iraqis before who I asked them, why don't you guys just overthrow your own government? Why do we have to do all this? And they said, well, who do you think keeps them in power, stupid?
Yeah. There
that
is
was,
a,
you know, a few years ago, two or three.
Yeah, yeah. What's more significant about that is the fact that people believe it. And here's the way the thought process goes. There, it's a very common conspiracy theory in the Middle East, or it was one before this last war, which was that they say things like, if American can do anything, American can go to the moon. They can transplant hearts. They can send up space shuttles. America can go to Panama and. They don't like a head of state. They can capture, Noriega. If they didn't like Saddam Hussein, they would have killed him a long time ago. Look what America can do. They can shoot a missile into a building and then send the second missile into the same hole. If the Americans allowed Saddam Hussein to live, it's because he's partly on their team. And so they were only punishing him because he stepped out of bounds. And one of the consequences, part of this conspiracy theory would say that because of Saddam Hussein, the other Arabs had to spend lots of money on American weapons. And because of Saddam Hussein, the Saudis needed to allow the Americans to keep bases in Saudi Arabia.
I'm sorry, but this conspiracy theory is sounding better and better to me.
yeah.
What's the illegitimate part again?
Say it again?
Well, what's the illegitimate part of this conspiracy theory? For example, Fareed Zakaria, who is one of the roundtable hosts on This Week on Sunday morning, and wrote in Foreign Affairs, the Council on Foreign Relations Journal, that if Saddam Hussein did not exist in the Middle East, we would have to invent him. He is the linchpin of our Middle Eastern policy. He wrote that in, I think, 96, 97.
Yeah. I just, you know, the I can say that I've read different versions from enough sources about his early career as an assassin. The historical fact that he was the first Iraqi to recognize Kuwait as a separate country about the time he became head of state, the fact that the United States did send satellite images, weapons, facilitated lots of good things going, when they facilitated even the chemicals for the gas attacks against Iran, when they attacked Halabja and gassed the Kurds, the response of the United States was to try to make a case that it was actually Iran that did it. And, you know, all of this, there's really good, clear, documented evidence that that's true. Now, the conspiracy theory about keeping him in power for 10 years just so that he could... it could be, but I haven't read. It's all speculation about what makes sense. Why would the United States leave him in power? Why did they not drive him out in the first Gulf War? Mind you, in the first Gulf War, it wasn't a half bad idea, because by leaving him in power, they had a ceasefire with an organized army that they could negotiate the return of POWs. And this was one big thing that, not that I want to say that one Gulf War was any better than the other, but people who were dissing George the Senior for not, quote-unquote, finishing the job, and saying that George W., he will finish the job. Before this war started, I knew, and anybody who knew anything about the Middle East knew, wait a minute, you smash Saddam Hussein, you smash the Iraq, you know, do the complete, total job. You don't have an army that's going to surrender in a intact fashion and maintain discipline and maintain order and so forth, and cohesion. It's going to be chaos and confusion. People who knew the Middle East knew that. Now, unfortunately, the government's getting advice. I mean, I hope one good byproduct of this unfortunate war, if there is a silver lining, is that the neoconservatives, the Project for the New American Century. I'm hoping all those people will be so discredited that they won't be able to give a whole lot more advice, unless hopefully it's advice to say how wrong they were, a confession of how wrong. To see those guys, for your listeners, here's how you can tell. I mean, you get so much information. You get contradictory information. How can you tell what's going on in the Middle East? And there's so much propaganda, and most people don't have time to go over there and study. It's a depressing subject. How do you know whose advice to listen to? Well, I read somewhere a woman goes into a restaurant with a guy. And this is a dating advice. If you want to impress the woman, you don't get into a fight with the waiter. A guy gets into a fight with the waiter at a restaurant, she's not going to hang around with him. If you're planning a trip to Mexico, you have one friend who talks to you about what a great time he had in Mexico and how everywhere he went, the people were friendly to him, and he went into this place and that place that nobody else had heard of the tourists. And then you have another friend who talks about Mexico, and everywhere he went, he outwitted the police, and he got into a shootout here, and he beat up people in the bar. He won all the fights he got, but he kept getting into fights. And his way of dealing with the Mexicans was to be prepared to fight all the time and stab people and all this. Now, you would probably not choose that as a travel companion to go to Mexico with. You would choose the guy who knows how to get along. But now what are we doing with our foreign policy? We have all these people, if they've ever been to the Middle East at all, and to the Arab world, they probably got into a fight with a cab driver in Cairo, and they spent their whole careers digging up every possible bad thing about the Arab world, everything they can twist or stack to convince you that the Middle East is and the Arabs are horrible people, and that they need to be, they need to have a war, we need to be willing to use nuclear weapons. I mean, they write stuff. They say we've got to get this taboo off about nuclear weapons. Let's redesign our nuclear weapons so that they can be usable.
This is the Weekly Standard crowd that you're talking about.
The
Weekly Standard.
Among other, there's that clique of people, Weekly Standard, Project New American Century, which is in the same building as the American Enterprise Institute. Wolfowitz is one of them. Lathe, Worms, they're all those people. They do not know the Middle East, and they hate what they can understand. There's writers like Pipes, P-I-P-E-S, I don't know if that's how you pronounce his name, but every time it's like they've made a profession. Now, on the surface of it, is there not a problem that somebody makes their own? Let's talk about Timbuktu. If there was somebody whose whole profession was just dissing the people of Timbuktu, and you spend your whole life writing about what horrible the people live there and how they've got terrible leaders, and we've got to prepare to bomb them, we've got to occupy them, we've got to overthrow, we've got to do this, we've got to do that, and manipulate. They should be suspect. They should be suspect. Now, our country's full of people in academia who know the Arab world. They learn Arabic and they know the good, the bad, and the ugly. But they have a balanced view of what the problems are in the Middle East and how best to not make them worse. And maybe there's a thing or two we could do to further understanding. That's where we should be taking our advice of. But who gets on our television? These talking heads that are just so hateful. And on the surface, when people's only solution to a problem is to go to war and to drop more bombs on somebody, or to hire local folk to kill other local folk, they should be suspect. Whatever comes out of their mouth is really poisonous. And that's what I'd like to say about those people. And the other thing I say is, if these guys, they could not, I listen to them talk, and I don't think they could order a falafel sandwich anywhere in the Middle East. Do you want to take advice on issues of life and death in a foreign country from someone who can't even tell you how to buy a falafel sandwich? I don't think any of them could buy a falafel sandwich, let alone tell you how much tahini to put on it and all the condiments. No, they're lost. They got the president's ear.
Speaking of these policymakers and their lack of understanding of the way things work there, and with your almost lifelong experience in the Middle East, I wonder if you can explain. I heard someone say that a standard tactic in desert warfare is to give up the city. And that doesn't mean the war's over at all. George Bush can come out on May Day and fly to an aircraft carrier and announce the war's over. But that a standard tactic is to give up the city and then harass later and force them out with low-degree, long-term pressure. Is that your understanding of the way things usually work?
I wouldn't know. It's and who knows what standard is. The for one thing, I happen to know that these tactics of warfare changed in the Middle East in 1922 with the introduction of airplanes, because the nomadic tribes would raid each other. They could go on long marches and loot a town, and that was the standard practice when things were not going well. But that came to an end with the very first airplanes. So as a standard, you can't really say what the standard is. And then there's just so many. I mean, every battle, every invasion is different. And Napoleon, he besieged Acre in Palestine in 1799, and after he did the siege for a long time, his people ran out of food and he decided to blow it off. But during the siege, he had captured 4,000 Albanian soldiers. I guess they were in the Turkish army. And he had executed them just so he wouldn't have to feed them. He just, instead of letting them go, he shot them all on the beach there in Acre. I don't know if people know about that. But I mean, they're just little tidbits like that throughout the history. So I can't honestly say that there's a standard practice to do this, that, or the other.
Well, at least that's a nice little tidbit about Napoleon, with all these little wannabe Napoleons running our government now.
I also
want to ask you, the interview's almost over, we're almost out of time, but I wanted to make sure and have you address the water situation. I've heard about cholera spreading all around, electricity that's consistently off in the major cities, and I wonder, what the hell is taking so long to get the water and the electricity online over there?
I honestly don't know. I'm out of my depth on that one. I know that the Americans are blaming Iraqi saboteurs. I have no idea if they damaged too much before. There is one cliche floating around, Saddam Hussein neglected the infrastructure. It's not precise, but that's more in the realm of propaganda. And in reality, Saddam Hussein did invest a lot into the infrastructure. Unfortunately, he also invested a lot in making war. There were sanctions. It's not a thing where I can say, yes, he did a great job with the infrastructure, or no, he neglected the infrastructure. That's not accurate. The infrastructure, the highway system is great. There are good highways. There were lots of good buildings. There was an electrical system. A lot of what broke down was due to the sanctions, and a lot was because of the wars that he got into. But when people just say stuff like, Saddam Hussein neglected the infrastructure, they're talking more propaganda than a real balanced analysis the devil's the devil, but you've got to be precise about what evil things the devil does and what tolerable things and what good things now and then, just for academic honesty. So getting back to these, I don't know how much it deteriorated before the war due to sanctions and not having enough investment in them, how much got damaged in the fighting, how much is getting damaged because looters are stealing from all of the stations, how much of it is people fighting the Americans by messing up the infrastructure. That's something that people do in warfare, unfortunately, and I can see them doing it, especially with the oil. If the Iraqis are feeling that the Americans are stealing it, well, they're going to be blowing up the oil pipelines. Why the electricity and water isn't happening faster, I honestly don't know what main setback is.
Well, I read an article not too long ago that said that the military came out and admitted that despite all the propaganda during the war, that it turns out only roughly a third of the munitions dropped from the air were laser-guided or joint direct attack munition, satellite guided, that most of them were just plain old dumb bombs, like always.
Yeah, I don't know that precise statistic there, but I now that you brought up the subject of bombs, the cluster bombs is a real nasty thing, because those spread out over a large area, and by their standards, I think they say about 5% do not explode, but that's assuming you drop it on hard surfaces. If it lands on the sand, then you have about a 30% so-called failure rate, where they're just sitting around waiting for things to happen. And I took a mine course while I was over there waiting to fly before the main combat had ended. And yeah, there are a lot of little things, like a bomb can go off just because of the temperature change. One of these cluster bombs, or bombs that for some reason failed to detonate. Well, just the change of temperature, the metal expanding, contracting, I don't know what, can suddenly set things off. The shadow passing over them can set them off. And they're there to people be getting hurt by them. Can you imagine that World War One? There, people still get hurt in Europe and in parts of Asia from bombs from World War One and World War Two, and Vietnam. Of course, they're still going off. I mean, Iraq's going to be suffering a century from now, just from the explosives, and who knows how long the depleted uranium dust is going to poison people. But that's a very big issue.
Yeah, the depleted uranium, they're still having problems from the last war, from the dust, from those munitions.
Yeah, so I think we're going to see, if people can approach this with the spirit of open inquiry instead of getting forced back, some people support it, the war will probably be backed into a corner and just say, well, it's all the Iraqis' fault. I mean, once you start with that logic, then that Saddam was the source of all evil, then any consequences can be put on his head. And I've had this debate before, and no matter how many evil things I say, depleted uranium, unexploded ammunition, friendly fire, missed bombs hitting civilians, okay, yeah, that's horrible, but it's all Saddam's fault, because Saddam made it necessary to have a war, therefore any consequences of the war are Saddam's. And there are people that'll get locked into that sort of position, but I'd hope there'd be a more open-hearted inquiry about is this the way we should be relating to the world when I mean, here's this thing that's already become a controversy now, and people supported the war having second thoughts. It's becoming a controversy, and in such a short time, and yet the bombs are going to be going off a century ago. People won't even understand what the controversy was right now. I mean, that's how horrible this thing is going to be for the long run. And I would like, vigorous inquiry to be taking place in public, in every forum possible, in the government, in civilians.
Are you going back?
I don't know. I feel a strong call to go back sometime in the fall. I have some reasons to stay here. My wife actually is going to Afghanistan on a photography shoot. And so she'll be gone pretty soon for about a month. And then we'll see what happens in the fall. I do know Arabic pretty well. And one of the problems that people are having over there is the soldiers is just communicating with the Iraqis, and I think a lot of their problems are happening, and I'm sure people have gotten killed just because of...
Maybe translating can help smooth over...
Yeah, I thought of doing that if, depending on what's going on, and then there'd be a question which group I would affiliate myself with, and there are questions like that. But remains to be seen. I'll decide in about 2 months.
Okay, well, if you go, we'd like to hear from you when you get back. know what's going on from someone who's been there. Ladies and gentlemen, Bill Kelsey. He is a pilot for AirServe, who flies relief missions into disaster areas all over the world, particularly wars, and who has been flying relief missions into Baghdad over the last couple of months. Thank you so much for joining us on the air today, sir.
Okay, appreciate your time.
You'll get used to killing. Just forget about that mortal coil. You'll become accustomed to things all too quickly.